Welcome to The Colorcast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. I'm Jason Myris, a colorist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Josh Petock, a colorist also in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo. And today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. We're doing a series of one-on-one interviews with different directors, producers, editors, color scientists, and colorists. And anybody we can kind of drum up that's interesting or has something interesting to say. And we're starting with actually somebody fascinating. It's Andrea Klayback. She's the lead DI colorist for a new film called Elysium. Did I get that right?
You got it right.
And she's going to tell us a little bit about her work and how she came to started this. So why don't you give us a background? How did you get started? How did you get to be in this position?
I actually thought I was going to be an on-set photographer. And so I kind of had my tried my hat at being on set, tried a bunch of different roles, and ended up kind of finding my way off of set eventually with it. Pretty quickly, and I sort of started editing and working in post, and it sort of seemed like a really natural kind of combination of two things together, which was, you know, creating images and editing images, and being a colorist was sort of, you know, kind of a very clear path for me, almost really quickly in my career.
Yeah.
I actually started working in visual effects for a bit, and one of the visual effects supervisors I worked with said, you know, you should really go and sit in the colorist chair for a while and see what that's like. It's, you know, you seem to have this sort of affinity for finishing images and looking at images in kind of a different way, rather than sort of the micro. I was just sort of a macro thinker.
Right.
So, yeah, it was kind of interesting. I started working with a company called Digital Film Group, which was an early iteration of the company Central that I work for now. And they started out primarily in the business doing digital to film transfers. So basically film recording.
Yep.
One of the first films they did was Atanajara at the Fast Runner. So that was like a big indie kind of digital, the film masterpiece that everybody had been talking about.
We should say you're based out of Vancouver, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
So I started sort of learning the ropes that way, and that company eventually turned into a DI facility, kind of expanded. And that's when I got the opportunity to kind of take the reins in color grading. So when we made a decision to buy a final color grading suite, it was Baselight, and that was kind of my science fair project. I got to, you know, look at every single one at the same time. We actually had a Luster, a Baselight, and a new Coda at a Pablo in the same room at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And so I got the opportunity to play on all of those for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And that sort of cemented my style, I would say, in terms of what I figured out, what I like to do, how I like to work. Baselight kind of was that choice for me.
I think you see a lot of that with, specifically with people with photo background tend to gravitate towards Baselight.
Yeah.
It seems to be like the workflow it has is really kind of that photo retouching workflow. You're doing layers. It's almost like Photoshop. You know?
Yeah.
Do you find that those skills that you developed doing photo work directly translate to film, partially translate to film? How does that work?
Absolutely. I think Baselight is one of those systems that I gravitated to simply because of that, the feel of layers and being able to work in a sort of non-destructive way. Something about the language of the interface and obviously the board, you know, many people have seen the board, but
do you have Blackboard 1 or Blackboard 2?
I have the 1, and I still think that, I mean, they're both incredible. I think it's a pretty amazing piece of machinery.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, you're sitting at it, but once you learn it, you never look down, you know, and that's something that it's basically becoming a part of an extension of you.
Mm-hmm.
Was something that was just, you know, clicked right away for me. So
I think you talked to a lot of colorists, and the thing that kind of makes people love a system is the invisibility of it.
Absolutely.
That's what you want, is you just want to focus in on the image. You don't want to be thinking about what's the interface doing, what page am I on, what button am I supposed to press. It's just you and the image and evaluating it and thinking about it.
Exactly. And at the time, I think Baselight was one of the only one systems that offered just the image on the screen you were working. So mm-hmm. your external monitor projection was your movie, and the interface is separate, and you kind of didn't need to be looking at either of those, the two, you know, the board or the interface to really do your work. You were, you know, just naturally working, and everybody is looking at the same image. That's now really common now.
Yeah.
At the time, there was lots of things where the tool sets would be on the screens that the director or the cinematographer would be staring at. It was just a different experience. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing with base light design that way is it's nice to for everybody to be seeing the same thing and nobody to be kind of going, oh, what are you doing now? You know, it's extremely obvious. It's like, you know, it's worth a thousand words in that way.
You have your room so configured so that you have your clients in front of you or beside you, or how does that work?
We have an option of both. Right now we have a nice built-in desk where I'm sort of at the helm of the back of the room. So right under the projection sort of booth or the portal. And then we have an option for clients to sit beside me. But I'd say that most often people choose to sit in front and nice the couches and, you know, lounge in the front and sort of talk that way.
I think it's a pure experience. Do you ever, like, when you're working on something, do you ever get to the point where you actually step away from the console? I do this where I just step up where the client's sitting, even if the client's not there, and just run through it and look at it. Sort of more...
Yeah.
It's a more pure way of seeing it, and you kind of spot stuff that you wouldn't otherwise when you're distracted by all the console and everything.
Yeah, definitely. I would start out working that way. So the first time I watched the film, when the kind of raw, or I'd say raw, but with a LUT, basic ungraded content, I'll sit in the, you know, the client center of the room and let, you know, one of the guys run the system for me, so just watch the film as it is.
Do you have them start and stop, or do you just keep running
just
through?
Roll through the whole thing for the most part, unless we see something like, oh, what was that weird, you know, technical glitch or something like that.
Wrong shot or,
like, oh, that was wrong, okay, just keep going. But you know, with sound, the whole thing, just watch it run through, and then I'll step back, and I'll typically work in my chair for a while, and then once I'm feeling like it's up to you know, spec, I'll do that again. I'll kind of return to the front of the room and watch it in different aspects, but typically I can you know, move around. It's not something that I think about too much, but
yeah, you have that different perspective. And I mean, I think there's key point moments where you just kind of have to get that.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you ever like find yourself just like stepping away or looking something in black and white? Or we're always trying to, like, colorists are always coming up with little tricks to kind of help us see it fresh again.
Completely, yeah.
Because that's the hardest part. But
thing is, you're in the room for sometimes 10, 12 hours at a time.
Right.
They bring you lunch in the room, and you kind of think, like, how could I possibly have perspective
what
on this?
What does daylight look like?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, sometimes, you know, in Vancouver, in the winter, you go in, and it's dark, and you come out, and it's dark, and it's as if the day never happened.
I was in Seattle for a while, so I was like, that was one of the big things. And the reason actually I left Seattle was, like, it's just
too dark and rainy. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, boy.
Well, the thing is, we get beautiful summer, so
yes. And you appreciate it more.
Absolutely.
People here don't appreciate the weather. We're in Los Angeles, by the way. Yeah. I should say we're in a cafe in I guess it's Santa Monica, and so if you hear background noise, or that's why. But yeah, that's
ambience.
You come here and it's like people are like, oh yeah, it's nice. I'm like, sure, yeah, it is. And as a New Yorker, I'm like, no, really. You have to understand, it's nice out.
It's always a lot. It's a line from the Vanilla Sky that I remember where it's like, yeah, man, the sweet is just. You know, it's not sweet enough without the sour.
That's true. Yeah. So let's dive in a little bit on specifically on Elysium, how you came to be involved, what was the process like, well, let's start with that, and then we'll go into how you came to develop the look.
Right. Well, Neil is obviously
Neil Blomkamp.
He's the director of the film and
did District Nine,
and did a lot of work out of Vancouver. Obviously, he's a Canadian citizen now, South African born, but lives in Canada, lives in Vancouver. Shot, I would say 50%. I think it is 50% of the movie is shot in Vancouver. So I think, you know, it was really enticing to him to be able to finish his film in Vancouver.
Vancouver is, we should say, you know, what I've been able to surmise. I haven't seen the film. It's the full film, but I've seen the trailer, and it seems like there's basically two sort of locations at play. There's the Elysium planetoid construction.
Space station, yes.
And there's Earth, which is kind of a barren wasteland.
Right.
So was Vancouver filling in for the barren wasteland? Or
absolutely not. No. Now, Vancouver was a lot of big set work that was designed. And it's so essentially Vancouver is Elysium and Mexico City, actually. A dump in Mexico City, in fact, I believe, is the setting for Earth.
Okay.
So
there you go. That gives you an idea of the, I mean, we're also talking about, and we'll get into this, the disparity of the two looks how you kind of set the tone for the two locations, and we'll get into that. But go on.
So, speaking about Neil, just him wanting to keep as much in Vancouver, I think, as possible in terms of his creative work. He had his editorial team up in Vancouver, obviously was shooting half of the film there. So it sort of seemed like a really natural solution to be able to do post and visual effects in Vancouver, have it all sort of tie in together in the same place. Obviously, you have to have the talent to do that.
Right.
So I thought from the very start, Image Engine, which is a visual effects primary visual effects company on the film, started to do pre-visual work. Of course, a lot of art direction in that was done by Weta, and but they were sort of signed on to do the project early on. We're about a block and a half away from Image Engine. We had worked with them on a number of projects, so we had a good relationship.
Yeah.
And so we actually started working on the film in terms of there was a sequence in the film that you'll see. I think it might be in the trailer, but it's essentially a kind of a technical feat of an arc rig of putting two red cameras at the end and a number of sort of still cameras among an arc.
Like a bullet time kind of thing.
Essentially, yeah. So like a new bullet time. And they started working on this, wanting to test this out on the stage because they wanted to see what it was going to look like. And so we kind of got involved. Our company does a lot of image processing, and so we were kind of signed on to, is this going to work? That we kind of helped them out to determine whether or not technically that rig was going to work in terms of the actual cameras they were using and the process they had.
So in place. In this case, you'd be matching basically Red Epic with Canon
5D.
5D.
Yes.
Okay, so the dreaded Canon 5D.
It's shooting video, but they're picking a frame from each of the cameras. I'm pretty sure we've got two cameras in the end, so 22 cameras in the 21 cameras in the middle.
Okay.
What the interesting thing about that is that each camera has a different color balance, even though they're all set to the same setting. Red obviously is
the chips. Yeah.
So to prove that this works well, we had to essentially make sure that there were. I mean, obviously, you can do some deflickering and sort of automated things, processes along that way.
Yeah.
But we wanted to kind of see image-wise if we could, because obviously you have to up-res that image to match it.
Yep.
Texture-wise with the red as well. I know we're going frame by frame. It's something that happens very quickly, but it was kind of an interesting kind of science project for us. So we got involved, actually. That was one of the first things we did, just to sort of prove that the concept was going to work. It wasn't the actual shot at play. It was test material.
Sure.
And then they, of course, were pretty happy with what they could do, so they went ahead and shot what they did. And so from that, we started actually working with the visual effects company because they really wanted to lock down color management and essentially determine how are they going to work. Obviously this film is 50% visual effects.
Sure.
It's always a good point that's made.
It was a little indie art movie.
Yeah, right. Canadian indie. So you think that's quite a feat. How are you going to get all of these effects to look real, which is the guiding theme of this whole process.
Sure.
Keep it real. To make it look real. And
Blomkamp, I mean, District 9 was really kind of very visually sort of cinema verite,
right.
And like the effects are just kind of seamless, and
yes.
And so this takes seamless effects takes a lot more work than just fancy flashy effects.
Yeah,
it's about the really the fine detail.
Yeah,
and a big part of that is color because
you
can do a lot to sort of enhance the effect, or you can do a lot to kind of make the effect less visible, less noticeable.
That's right.
Yeah.
When I got involved, that was at the forefront, was color was not meant to be a transformative, process in a way. It's not necessarily something we wanted to use as a filtration to make everything look a certain way, which is sometimes a good way of working. It's obviously can command a fantastical look, a film like this with crazy flying vehicles and that sort of thing.
Sure.
The guiding theme was always to sort of actually keeping it look as real and honest as possible.
Mm-hmm.
With that being the first note, that almost the first thing that Neil ever said to me in terms of this film, we kind of took color
as real as a sci-fi futuristic dystopian.
It's a complete paradox,
yeah.
Right? I mean, obviously, you're thinking like, we've got man-sized droids walking around. That none of this is real, but for it to work, it needs to feel real instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Needs to feel plausible and very connected to the audience immediately, rather than people trying to figure out where they are.
So you get Neil in the door with the VFX work.
Yeah.
What's the next step? How does it go from that to doing the full DI?
Right. So essentially, we actually, at that point, we were doing beta testing for Aces mm-hmm. color.
Yep.
And we had actually already...
So you used Aces on this project.
So Aces has been used on
wow.
a laser. Yeah.
Okay.
We both are... he's a technical director or operations manager, Chris Davies. Very technically sound in terms of color management. Works a lot with True Light teams
yep.
and that. Was directly in touch with the guys at Aces.
And the Baselight guys, because Aces is not is going to be fully implemented in 4.4, but 4.3 was kind of a workaround, right?
I would say a little bit. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just there wasn't anything in place for it. We essentially had to develop our system for
your
that.
Your pipeline. Were you using the straight up linear Aces, or were you using, like in your controls, were you using the kind of the log Aces modification?
Yeah, so interestingly, because the visual effects wanted to work in linear, mm-hmm. We had our workflow sort of went in a way, and so that we actually pre-graded all the visual effects plates in linear.
Yeah.
When the images came back, we turned
polish.
It into log. So we all my grading was done in log. Actually, so the control feel was the same for me,
mm-hmm.
But the actual incoming files were linear. Yeah.
So you were doing a 1D transform LUT on.
Yeah, the Aces has a number of different transform LUTs that you use in terms of getting things from point A to point B.
Sure.
And that was essentially one of them, an IDT that takes you from linear into Aces, and then in Aces you can do your work.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a different it was definitely something to get used to at first. But I had already been working on two features and a TV series at that point in Aces because we were kind
of
part of
the
beta team. Yeah.
And
they had visual effects in there
yeah.
as well. So it was kind of a...
That's the kind of key advantage there. It's like the hassle of Aces right now because it's still kind of in development.
Yeah.
If you're not doing a lot of VFX and you're not having to interact with a lot of VFX, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
But if you're doing VFX, the advantages kind of outweigh the disadvantages.
Yeah. They
yeah.
definitely do. And for this team, they of course wanted to make sure that what they were going to be showing Neil was what he was going to see in the final film.
Right.
We all thought about it. You know, they're going to spend all this time making just the tiniest details and glints and highlights perfect, so that you know when this character walks across the screen, there's absolutely no question as to whether that's real or not. And if they weren't working in the same environment as I was, then there was going to be a lot of question as to, is she going to wreck it? Or
yeah.
am I, you know, and for me to say, oh, this is what you guys wanted it to look like, and, you know. So it actually completely flattened that sort of fear and curiosity as to whether or not we were all seeing the same thing.
Here's what it looks like.
Yeah. So they, you know.
Were they monitoring? They would switch on, they were using Nuke or whatever, and they would switch
yeah.
on a sRGB ODT
yeah.
and look at an sRGB.
Yeah.
Make decisions about the comp, and
yeah.
then send it back to you, and you'd look at it actually in P3 or whatever.
Well, they actually got to the point in their pipeline where they would be able to review it all in P3 as well. So we were able to kind of work with them to set up their theaters.
Oh, great! Well. So they had a theater space. Well.
Yeah.
Plus,
so
you were only a block away. So.
Only a block away. So it was all. It was. I would say it was a rare collaboration between a visual effects company and a DI facility that are not, you know, in the same. Under the same corporation,
right.
if that makes any
yeah.
sense. Worked really well with them. You know, both had sort of a transparency to our workflow so we could completely interact or integrate with each other.
Okay. Let's backtrack a little bit.
Yeah.
And get, because we started down the path because you were telling us about how you and Neil
yeah.
came and worked together.
Right.
So let's finish that thought.
So, yeah, we started talking about honesty and realism. And I think right away I just kind of, he's extremely articulate, so I just picked that up right away.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question as to what he meant. Obviously, he's not, you know, a filmmaker of 25 years. Him and I are relatively close in age. He's made a few, obviously, one massive, a brilliant film that everybody knows about, and a number of short films. But he's
and
not
commercials.
And commercials,
yeah.
but not. You know, he's kind of relatively new to the feature film world. And I think we just kind of connected right away in terms of what he was looking for.
Sure.
In terms of, you know, what he has done with District 9 and kind of moving forward with Elysium into kind of a different look. But but adopting a lot of the similar stylistic choices that he has sort of going in his overall, you know, creative vision.
He's developed a sort of signature style.
Yeah.
But he's sort of, it's kind of taking it to the next level with Elysium.
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, he's very visual effects heavy, right, or centric in terms of his vision.
Yeah. He also likes handheld a lot.
Yes.
That can be tricky to grade too, because you're doing, it's not like a lockdown shot where you can do windowing and all that stuff really easily.
That's right, yeah.
You're having to do very careful tracks and a lot of rotoing. And
yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Were you doing all of it in Baselight? Were you sending stuff out to get rotoed and bringing in mats?
You know, interestingly enough, I think part of that style of, you know, cinema verite, which, you know, I would use loosely in terms of Elysium, but it has definitely made its way into the style of how this film was shot, and you can still be able to see it, simply because that's sort of the doctrine moving forward into this naturalistic, you know, naturalism with extreme visual effects.
Right.
But in terms of the broad stroke of things, there was actually not a huge amount of rotoing required in terms of grading.
Okay.
Because a lot of the work we were doing was sort of, you know, in subtext, and I guess that makes any sense.
Sure.
We're doing a lot of, you know, his style is not so much to kind of change what was shot. Of course, if there was anything that we needed to, you know, extreme matching differences, that's a different scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, you know, overall scenes and, you know, directing your eye towards a character and that sort of thing, there's definitely subtle things involved, but in terms of rotoing, a lot of that stuff would just be done in visual effects.
So let's say you're not doing a lot of, it sounds like you weren't doing a lot of windowing. It wasn't a lot of that kind of work to draw the eye. So what kind of stuff were you doing? I mean, a lot of it gets done on set on these things. It's like the shots are really well thought out, particularly because you're doing effects shots.
Yeah.
And you have to really think about, how are we going to do the effect? How are we going to track this? So that stuff gets really detailed and gets very well planned out.
Yes.
Generally.
Yeah.
Not always. But then other stuff like dialogue scenes or something, they may not have that level of detail in it. And so you may come into the color session and they may be like, you know what, this shot really wanted to focus on Matt here.
Yeah.
But, you know, this background's actually a little too hot. What are the techniques you're using to kind of redirect the eye to frame the shot, reframe the shot, refocus the shot?
A lot of the times using keys and trying to play with shadows and highlights in their own right. Say that we didn't use shapes. I definitely used grads and shapes to knock out, you know, crazy white awnings in the background, things that were just not in control of the cinematographer at the time when they were shooting, because they're shooting in a big marketplace in Mexico City that has, you know, a bunch of civilians, you know, essentially people that are not part of the film walking around. So there's definitely things going on. So a lot of shapes and in terms of really subtle, you know, knocking away of backgrounds. Of course, Matt Damon in the film, beautiful big blue eyes, obviously is something that we have to highlight as it moves forward. And you know, obviously you get to know each actor as their, how light hits their face or doesn't.
Sure.
So there's things that you use over and over. In terms of, and Jodie Foster as well being in the film, you know, there's a lot of close-ups between those two characters, not them interacting directly, but of course throughout the film.
Oh, no.
So there's definitely, you know, there's definitely a lot of kind of subtle shapes that I would use. But I would say mostly it would be, I do a lot of work in just keying out certain things.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that in base, like my stacks are pretty high. I have probably like, you know, up to 15. We actually worked over the course of about 4 months, which is a gift for DI. And so what we were able, because a lot of the reason for that was so that we could kind of return to it, step away, come back.
It's the best way.
And both Neil and I love the idea of just like, let's keep it very zen. Let's, you know, get a chance, get some distance, come back, watch it again, feel it. Because to me, real is something you feel. It's not something that you can put a word or, if I put this color on, it's going to feel real. If I make it gritty, it's going to feel real.
Yeah.
It's just something that you feel. And I think in order to feel it, it just needs to sit on the edge of something. The only way you can get onto the edge is by kind of
refining
and get to that point. Not getting kind of going down a tunnel. Because you can definitely go that, you know, you can sit in a room for 10 hours and end up somewhere you never thought you would, which can be a really amazing thing, but it can also be detrimental to to something in terms of this.
Did you find yourself like bouncing around? Were you like going? Were you trying to do a scene at a time, a shot at a time? Were you bouncing from one reel to another? Were you working on one reel exclusively? Or
well, how we started because there was obviously the big visual effects pipeline that had to happen in between between shooting and during editorial and DI.
Yep.
We started with a look session where I went through the film as it existed in a rough cut stage and pulled, you know, hero shots or scenes, let's say about 20 from the film, and Neil and I got a chance to look at them all and really like go crazy, even though he had a really distinct vision of what he wanted that to look like.
Yeah.
We actually it was kind of a fun experience because we would sort of sit back and go, okay, let's just go totally different with this, because it allows that reaction versus instruction, and that was really, to me, really valuable.
It also lets you see where the limits are. This is as far as we can push it. But now we know. Let's figure out where the sweet spot is.
Sets the tone for everything. So we did a big look session. That's how actually we developed a look in terms of visual effects. So we made an Aces LUT that had an Elysium look.
Mm-hmm.
And they used that for their sort of 8 months out of a year to do the effects work.
So for the VFX pipeline, you would, say, conform off the shot on red?
That's right.
Okay. So you would conform off the R3D files.
That's right.
You would do a base grade.
We called it a neutral grade at the time. You could call it a setup grade. It's kind of, I wouldn't say it's exactly neutral because it's more defined to the look of the eventual look of that scene.
But it gets you a kind of a starting point.
It's your starting point.
And that you would spit out for VFX.
Right. So we actually worked in OpenEXR.
Great.
Because we felt like this was going to be the best workflow.
It's also the standard traces.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it allowed for, to keep obviously all of the range you needed to work in at the same time as just, of course, creating a standard for all the VFX companies that were going to work on film.
Spinning out the OpenEXR has this kind of the Elysium base grade, the starting point. And then they're also getting a LUT. And that LUT has the Elysium look. So they're putting that LUT on their chain in Nuke or whatever they're using, Jake or whatever they might be using. And so they're doing their composite, and they're always seeing it with the Elysium look.
That's right.
But then it gets taken off, and you get back a Elysium flat pass for your session.
Mm-hmm, which is great, because you know, I was able to, as it's one of the processes that we used so that we could spend a lot of time on this DI, was something called, we call it shadow conform. It's like a rolling DI.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, we conform the show as the edit is committed at the time, so whatever the current edit is, we'd be able to get the CDL EDLs from editorial, conform the show as it existed, so we'd have obviously non-VFX shots that would be edited together at the same time as potentially just VFX plates if there was no element complete, but if there was final shots being delivered back to us, we'd have those in term, so we'd have a full show all the time running.
Yeah.
And what was kind of cool about that is, as you get a visual effect shot back, you'd be able to sort of butterfly the original plate, then the effect shot.
Yep.
There's nothing, all that's different is the element or whatever they're putting into it.
Right.
I mean, obviously some of them are very complex.
Are you stacking this on top, or are you doing the, I know Bayside has you can change the path.
Yeah. That's so right.
That's the easiest way to swap shot.
Stacking it so we could always see, the background, what the plate was, so that there would be no question. Obviously, as we moved forward and we were out of the plate world and we had 90% visual effects, we got rid of all the plates. We didn't really need them in the scene.
Sure.
But it's nice. I mean, the thing is, it causes no, it's just an organizational feat, essentially, to keep that in the background. It's nice to be able to see the history of a shot and where it started from and where it got to. So
this is strictly a 2D release. You're not doing 3D?
No 3D, yes.
So that's a blessing for you. It makes it a little bit easier.
Everybody, yes.
but you are doing IMAX, right?
That's right.
And that's going to be IMAX film or IMAX DCP?
Both.
Okay.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about the look of the film and get a little away from the technical and more into the artistic here. How did you guys develop that? Am I correct in assuming that there's sort of, you were going for kind of two distinct different feels? And this is an interesting, how do you bridge the gap? Because from the trailer, you can infer that Matt Damon is making his way to a museum.
Sure.
And so at some point, you're going to end up in a museum. How do you bridge the gap, taking Matt Damon from one environment where you can kind of push him one way and still have them seem like the same person
right.
when you push them the other
yeah.
way.
Yeah. That's a really key point. I mean, obviously, upon first look at the film, just by theme, you think we've got polar opposites. Mm-hmm. We've got this immaculate space station. It's completely futuristic. It's completely clean. And, you know, there's machines on that that don't... on the space station that don't exist in reality, and there people can be healed of cancer, and you know, all this crazy environment.
Sure.
And then you've got obviously a typical dystopian, you know, future Earth that at least could go that way. It couldn't be more opposite. Obviously, that's a huge defining theme in the film.
Right.
And then to say, how do you know, we could just make these look totally different.
Sure. We could pull the traffic.
Pump, yeah, exactly. We could just pump Elysium full of, like, saturation. We could make it look, you know, really, like, really clinical. Or, you know, there's all these things we could do.
Mm-hmm.
And lush and, you know, colorful. And we could just totally suck out all the color from Earth. And, you know, there's, obviously, there's lots of approaches.
You could go really contrasty on Earth. And
to me, I thought, you know, yeah, you want to make sure that... it was always about making sure they felt like the same movie.
Sure.
We're watching the film and we don't have two different films going on. We actually have one sort of cohesive film
right.
that has a very polar element in it. As you said, you know, we have Matt Damon eventually making his way to Elysium. That was actually a kind of a visual narrative cue that I took in terms of, and it's definitely in art direction cinematography as well. Stylistically, it's kind of pulled. So color grading was sort of, I always say, didn't take a backseat, but it was sort of being guided by the elements that are naturally in the film.
You're right? there to support the overall yeah, vision.
Exactly.
So,
you know, obviously you're cutting in between, though, Earth and Elysium. So there's definitely a lot of care in terms of how different those look, but how similar they look.
Mm-hmm.
Narrative-wise, I think one of the big keys was to keep them looking kind of at contrast from each other at first. And so you've got a very, you know, nice, clean environment, and you really kind of bump up the sort of volatile environment of Earth.
Sure.
Make each of the scenes look kind of different from each other. Not in a super extreme way.
I should ask just for clarification here that we're within the structure of the film itself, you're intercutting throughout
right.
the film.
That's
so
right.
you're kind of going back and forth.
Yeah, you're seeing Jody on. You're seeing Jody in Elysium, and you're seeing Matt on Earth. And so because those intercut and they're, you know, interacting with each other and this communication is going back and forth between Earth and Elysium, I think that it was key that they kind of felt like the same time
right.
as well. But what we did was we tried to maintain Elysium's environment as being kind of consistent. So at the very beginning of the film, it sort of is a consistent environment. In other words, pretty much matching every single scene as you come back to it, it looks like exactly the same, almost perfectly matched.
So when you're grading that, are you taking the Elysium stuff out of context
yeah.
and just kind of grading it all together?
Yeah, that was one way that we started.
Mm-hmm.
We took all of Elysium from front to end, and we just graded a series of scenes from that and just put it together and said, what do these all look like?
Right.
Then we took all of Earth, and of course Earth is all, you know, completely different environments. And what we started to find was, what made it interesting was to kind of play off of the scene in terms of what was going on, what characters were in the scene, that sort of thing, rather than making Matt Damon look exactly the same in each scene.
Sure.
Sort of said, okay, well, right now we're in this, like, it's a really high, intense environment. Let's kind of go with a bit of a crazy color here, because we wanted to keep Earth kind of feeling... not inconsistent in a color way, but inconsistent in a sort of feel way, and that, like, it's varied. It's I call it volatile.
Okay.
Each scene is volatile to what's going on around it. Yeah. We realized that they were starting to really be influenced by
context,
the actual
of the scene.
Context of the scene.
Yeah.
And we kind of let that happen. So as it intercuts, it's kind of obvious. You know, it's ideally to be sort of subconscious, but as you look at it more academically, you can kind of see an obvious difference between just being kind of like chaotic on
mm-hmm.
Earth and very
serene.
Consistent, serene in Elysium. As the story progresses, we kind of tried to bring those elements from Earth onto Elysium, and I think that was sort of the key. That there's a defining moment in the film where all of a sudden it's almost like it starts to infect, I would say, for
okay.
lack of a better word. Earth look starts to sort of influence
Make
the way
its way into Elysium.
The thing is, Elysium is man-made, it's human, So it's sort of a natural, it's a kind of a natural look to sort of play in. It fits together, and I felt like it sort of just was a nice way to kind of tie those two worlds into each other as the story progressed.
So as Matt Damon's character makes his way to Elysium, so does the look of Earth make its way to Elysium. Interesting. So, did you guys have any when you started this? Did you have any did they bring you any references? Any reference points? Were they like, this is a film I want to kind of allude to, or this is something I want to draw from this film or that film?
It's a good question. We, that's a great starting point for most films I work on. It's like, okay, well, if you had five films that you reference, what would they be?
Mm-hmm. And they're usually like completely different films. They're just different. Let me think about that for a little bit.
I, even on my own, while I was working prior to the full sort of principal DI, I was trying to find something that would be really good, a good reference. We didn't have anything very specific, but what I knew was that as a filmmaker, Niels obviously, and we are all influenced by things that we grew up with and watch, and films that I know that films that he loves, and that would naturally have influenced what he does. But I would say he has kind of a hybrid style. So I'd look at lots of documentaries, look at obviously District 9 is interesting but different, mm-hmm. and tried to kind of gain that style from what I felt was in there. I felt like there was a lot of references to almost like 80s and 90s sci-fi films in terms of stylization.
Any in particular?
Terminator, Alien, Aliens, both of those. Sort of a classic sci-fi feel. Mm-hmm. To a certain degree. So that was definitely what influenced Elysium in terms of, overall vibe and color.
You can kind of see that in the trailer, sure. Yeah, kind of the coolness, sort of pristine white, and then you've got a very kind of even balance. You have the green isn't overly saturated, but you see some green that is totally absent in the Earth scenes in the trailer.
Yeah, exactly. And no green is to, exist on Earth in this particular date in future. So that was a defining color difference between the two.
Yeah.
Earth was a little bit different because it sort of didn't have all of those sort of sci-fi.
Max.
Yeah.
Really?
Perfect. Exactly. Okay. Obviously, the character's name is Max in the film. It was kind of funny that we were doing a lot of the elements in the movie in terms of the set design and direction were almost lo-fi. Hi-fi tech, lo-fi high tech, this kind of weird polar opposite.
Sure.
And so, Mad Max is a definite, the dusty with the blue skies and that sort of look is definitely part of it. I wouldn't say that it's an obvious influence, but there's definitely cues from a number of films that we used almost subconsciously at first and then kind of went, oh, this actually really reminds me of Alien. Like, this is like that scene or a scene in the Space Odyssey where, in the space station when this is happening. It would kind of come out after. And then we'd watch that. Oh, wow. We totally, we were very, both of us very influenced, by these looks.
I wonder how that comes about because I think there's an element of, okay, you're drawn towards something.
Yeah.
And then I think the other element is the familiarity of it, even subconsciously. You're like, that looks right.
Yeah, exactly.
And then later you're like, oh, that's because it's something else I saw earlier.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But it's kind of nice to look back and say, oh, that's kind of RoboCop-y. Oh, that sort of feels like Alien. And it's sort of there's kind of a variety of influences that you see now watching it. And I was saying the other day after seeing it for the, 111th time, I say, it's really, to me, the voice of Neil Blomkamp is really evident in the film because it's obviously in this blockbuster world now. But it has kind of a different voice, and it's got a voice that's influenced by all of these other big blockbuster voices, but they're kind of culminated in a different, in a unique way.
Yeah,
which I find really interesting about just his style in general.
Well, you look at filmmakers that are name filmmakers that have a draw, and they tend to have a style, right? There's definitely a Blomkamp style.
It's making its way
into the consciousness.
Yeah.
And so, how does it feel to be a person kind of? Maybe guiding, but also executing that style.
As I learned and started to truly believe in the style that was in place, it took me not very long to pick it up. But as I started working, I was kind of very concerned. Oh, I really don't want to make this look too extreme.
Sure.
We were always sort of catching ourselves. And in fact, we would have times just when we needed mental breaks in the middle of a session to sort of looking at a scene and say, okay, let's just make this look like Domino, just for fun, or, you know, something like that, just in terms of just going wild and crazy,
And you also sometimes make, I've done this where I make accidental discoveries.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, you know what, we could do a magenta push on that side of the wall, and it's actually kind of interesting, and it might work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we definitely, you know, I remember doing a lot of work that way, but in terms of responsibility, you know, it's a funny thing, because maybe it's just the length of time I spent on the project, but I felt like I became a believer right away in terms of how it was meant to look,
sure.
And that the minute it didn't look right, you know, it was like, no, that's wrong. We have to, you know, have to change that. And the minute, and now getting into sort of the mastering stage and seeing this film in different, in these different formats.
Are you seeing it change?
Definitely see it change.
The film print changes it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's to me, there's like a little line where, oh, it's crossed. Now this isn't the film anymore. So, you know, it's definitely a huge responsibility. It's quite a large film. There's tons of elements in terms of visual effects to keep, you know, in line.
Sure.
And all of this work that's been done. But at the same time, because the approach is kind of natural, it sort of just almost seemed like effortless to a certain degree. So you kind of have to take a step back and realize what you're doing.
To get back into the technical side a little bit. You guys were working in 2K, 4K?
So we worked in 3.3K, which would be the...
Of course.
Yes, of course, right?
Yeah.
You think, what the heck is that? That was the goal of keeping actually the original... That's the original source resolution.
Oh, okay.
So it was anamorphic. So it was the epic anamorphic 3296 by 1550.
Okay.
So essentially that's the...
So you worked the anamorphic all the way through the chain?
Yeah.
Great.
And so visual effects got to work on those files at the same. We call them 3.3K. I guess that's what it makes sense.
Huh?
To me, I don't know what that means. But the idea is that up-reses really well, really, really easily to 4K. But it's actually a very workable resolution in terms of playback and speed and copying and all that. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. You get a very high resolution. You're kind of working from the natural, like the source file resolution,
right,
and then when you go to master in 4K, you're making a relatively small jump. Yeah, exactly.
Well, so, you end up, because if you're going scope at 4K, it's whatever, it's like 4096 by 1600 or something. So
right.
you do end up kind of just going, go bloop. I'm actually making a gesture. You go wide and squat, and that's how you end up with scope.
Right.
Which works out really well, because it's like you don't really lose anything.
It's extremely minimal, like, sides of the image. So,
yeah.
So 4K is the final, essentially,
the final format.
Everybody worked in 3.3K.
What's your, if you had to pick one way to see the film, what are you picking?
Good question. I would definitely pick big screen 4K digital cinema.
Projection.
Simply because that was our master. That was what we worked in. The whole time.
This is a really good point.
Yeah.
It's for some films, it's the primary master is actually the film master, like you mentioned. That's the one you're targeting. And for some, it's DCP, and for some, it's even broadcast or whatever. So
right.
It's like,
I would look at my iPad. You know, that we were all laughing. Like somebody would say, "Well, this is going to get mostly seen in digital cinema," and everybody's like, "Well, it's probably going to be mostly seen on somebody's iPhone." But what are you going to do? There's not going to be an iPad pass
yet.
That's
true.
And that would be that would probably be the one I would.
Although you could do 2K on the iPad.
You could.
Yeah. So you're doing a huge DI.
Right.
It's a big movie, and you're one of really just a handful of women that are in this field at this level, maybe not even a handful, like it's maybe three, you know? I mean, do you think that gives you a different perspective? Do you think it gives you, do you think as a woman you have a different eye than a man would? Do you think you have a different aesthetic? Or is it just, you're just doing the work and there's a genetic component, we'll get off on a geeky track here, that women actually will generally be less likely to be colorblind and can actually potentially see color better than any man could.
Yeah.
And yet you don't see many women at this level, and you don't see many women at this game.
Right.
So I'm just wondering if you have a perspective on that, if you have thoughts on it.
You know, it's interesting because it comes up a lot, you know, as you get to this level of film, people are almost, you know, it's odd how they're surprised to see, you know, you're one woman in the room of about 12 the 12 men basically sure. making the decision. I it's funny because I don't think about it that often until somebody brings it up.
Yeah.
So in some way I would say, yeah, I'm just kind of doing the work, and then I feel like it's just a natural, I'm just doing what I do. And it's, I sat with the Color Timer a few days ago looking at one of the release prints of Elysium, and he was saying, well, you know, if you, I'm, to me, this looks okay, but if you maybe see, you know, women see color way better than men do. So anyway, like, I'm flat out admitted. I was like, well, you know, I never heard that too. And I think there's probably some truth to it, but I don't know. I mean, everybody's so different. And there's the subjective point of view that comes through whether or not the technical, you know, aspect genetically of our eyes are, I can see color more. There's definitely a personality thing that gets in the way of being a colorist or, you know, I think, to me, a colorist is almost more about being able to relate to people. And I always think that, that's maybe more of what you do, is being able to actually translate what somebody's talking to you into something on the screen.
Do you think you work more emotionally in that sense? I think there's a...
Probably, yeah.
Probably, my work is probably technical.
Yeah.
And where I feed an aesthetic, I'm feeding an aesthetic that's contextual to the story, but maybe not emphatic with a character or with what the audience is experiencing. It's more like, okay, how am I going to feed the story here?
Right.
And so I tend to approach it from a very logical perspective.
Yeah.
You think that's your perspective, or
no,
different? Okay.
Yeah. So my perspective is definitely, you know, when I talk about baselight as being a good tool for me, that's kind of part of that. It's like I will sit down, look at an image, and just start kind of feeling it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, obviously having previous discussions about, well, what do you want this to communicate? Okay. But then I'd rather than think about what I'm about to do. Often I'm in the room with some DPs and they'll be like, so what are you doing now? And I always kind of look down and
I'll tell you what I'm done.
I think I just made it bluer. Not, you know. So I there's definitely a different approach there.
Yeah.
It's definitely more of a gut feeling, emotional, definitely more of an emotional response. Maybe mm-hmm. that's what it is. I don't really typically think about it, but, you know, when I look back and try to analyze how I got to a certain point, it's almost always by feel and not necessarily analyzing like a technical route to the end. But I mean, maybe it's just how it was brought up in the film industry in terms of technology. I had to be able to speak that language as well.
Sure.
So the ability to have that kind of really lean on that like creative side
mm-hmm.
when I need to, but be able to totally switch it and talk about EXRs and floating point and, you know, is this going to be 16-bit or, you know, what kind of color space are we working in? That sort of thing has definitely added, you know, a balance to how I work.
That's a must have for the work that you're doing.
Yeah, definitely.
But, I mean, you do feel like there's a different perspective that you have that maybe a male colorist wouldn't have.
I don't know. Maybe. I'm not sure if it's because I'm a woman or it's because
of just who you are.
Of just who I am.
Yeah.
And I think of myself as, well, I was a photographer, started in a file-based world. I learned about color timing, but I was never a timer in terms of film laboratory processes. But I learned my film industry post through laboratory, not through Telecine. Didn't have a lot of video experience, to be honest. So obviously knowing about video, but I didn't grade with tape to tape ever. Mm-hmm. So
your visual background, would you say it was primarily photo-centric?
Yeah, I would say so,
yeah.
I was a painter as well, so I kind of come from all these different, environments and those kind of culminate to me to kind of make that process a bit different. So maybe it's unique in terms of that, but I don't know if it's necessarily because I'm a woman or not. I have an older brother who's huge into sci-fi. I was definitely the girl among the boys during my whole life. So it could just be that that's a natural fit for me.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't think of it, I'm almost more comfortable in a room with a bunch of guys than I am in a room with a bunch of women. So maybe that it's part of that too. It's a more natural environment for me.
One of the things I love about color is it's a very kind of left brain, right brain thing where you're just kind of mixing the two.
Yeah.
And you can't really do one without the other. You can be really technical, but you're not going to get very far. You can be really creative, but you have to be able to do the language at least in terms of the technology. Let me take it away from you personally and just ask you broadly for your perspective on why do you think there are so few women colorists? And what can we do about it?
Well, I was trying to make that point earlier about personality, and I don't know where I was going there, but I almost think it's just that, you know, it's the environment that feeds itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
It's a boys' club.
It's a boys' club.
Yeah.
And if you, like I said, if I'm, I feel like I'm maybe in that, other the women that are involved or have that same perspective, I don't know exactly. But if it's a comfortable for you, if it's not daunting to be in a room with a bunch of guys making decisions and talking about, you know, the
and you can cool, hold your
stuff,
own and speak
your
up.
Own,
yeah.
You almost get kind of an elevated, you know, seat at that table to a certain degree, because people, they kind of turn. I was in a meeting once where somebody said, well, you must be good because, you know, there's no way you would be here in this position if you weren't. Thinking like, that's a really strange thing to say.
It's a little offensive.
Slightly, yeah. You know, but it's true that, you know, if you get to that point, you almost kind of get treated, you know, with that respect, because you can hold your own and do that. It just seems like odd in this day and age that we kind of still talking about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think
it's so, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, maybe it's 2-3% of colors or whatever.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It's so insanely low.
It could also be that the what you have to do to work as a colorist, in terms of you got to sit in a room for 10 hours straight with
sure.
one person, sometimes two people,
or by yourself.
By yourself. That's hard for me. I'm a really social person. Part of what I like is working with
people. Do you ever drag somebody into the room just
yes.
to have them?
Can you talk to me? Because I'm going to talk about something while I'm doing this. Yeah, I mean, I have a pretty good focus, you know, ability. I've been told that I have this kind of, you know, good sense of being able to kind of just dive into something and
sure.
work with it. And then hours pass, and you're like, oh, what time is it?
Yeah.
But I definitely feel the most fed by my profession when I'm working with somebody and able to get them
feedback.
To react and sort of kind of progress something that way. So.
So do you have like people in your office that are like your little guinea pigs for trying color out? Are you like, come in and just sit there and just wait, and just wait till you go, ah, you're like, okay, that's it.
Yeah, because they're all quite different. It's kind of, we have a small team. We're
yeah.
kind of a boutique facility, if you can say. There's about 8 of us that actually
oh, wow.
produced the DI on this film, which is a little bit crazy. But so, and they're all quite different personalities. So it's actually quite good for me, because I'll bring one person and I kind of know where he's gonna want out of this and get his reaction, and then, you know, get the other. And the thing is a lot of them are quite technical, so sometimes I don't bring them in because they'll be like, well, that's crushing the blacks, and da-da-da-da-da, you know. So I'm like, well, maybe that perspective isn't the best for me.
Do you find like you have to, I find I have to sometimes make a clean break between the kind of technical evaluation and the aesthetic evaluation, right? Yeah, the blacks are crushed, but it works for the shot,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
But if
yeah.
you're always thinking about are the blacks crushed, you end up with like these ridiculously flat looks. I think
yeah.
this is part of what feeds that kind of
exactly.
Yeah. So
to me, it's always about perspective and like being realistic. You know,
yeah.
in terms of does this serve the film, or is, you know, is this just a technical decision?
It's sometimes the hardest thing is getting that kind of like that, because the only people see it in the shot, if it's
yeah.
a 2-second shot, a 3-second shot,
yeah.
they see it for an instant, right?
Yeah.
And so it's about that gut reaction to what it looks like.
Yeah.
And it's when you're looking at it for 15, 20, 30 minutes, an hour, it's really hard to get that gut reaction,
yeah.
right? How do you do that? How do you come back to it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I definitely try to get that first reaction. Almost a lot of times I spend a lot of time writing and just recording how I felt sometimes when I first see something.
Really?
So I'll...
Like, you take notes?
Yeah. So I'll watch something through. Actually, when I was saying that before, I watch a film through or even a scene through, I'll kind of just say, okay, this is what I thought right away. Then I would go play with it, look at it, and then, you know, if I have the time to step away, or if I can't step away, I'll go work on something else, like
mm-hmm.
a different scene or a different part of the film. And then later at the end of my day or at the end of that, you know, session, go back and say, okay, now what do you think, you know, or if somebody's in the room with me or not, kind of look at that again and say, okay, is that in line with, and look at what I wrote. That's interesting. I wrote that, and this is how I felt, and this is what I did. Okay, now I'm going to tweak it a little bit to kind of go back to work, because that was more of a gut reaction that I had. And it tells you a lot about what you're seeing and how you feel. And you kind of forget that along the way, so it's good to kind of maintain the perspective.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, that's the only way I do it.
Perspective is the hardest thing, right?
Write it down. I also kind of, one of the cool things I try to do is put myself in the mode, because you don't always listen to the film as you're working. I kind of try to get music from the film. Not necessarily the exact soundtrack, but something that would be influential.
Sure.
And I just create this playlist the whole time I'm working on it. So you can imagine how long the Elysium playlist is. and our Elysium playlist like floated from a crazy, you know, blockbuster movie
scores
like Zimmer and, you know, all the big ones. Sure. And then somehow towards the end it was gangster rap. I'm not sure how we got there, but, you know, it sort of morphed into this. You
I
know,
feel like I can see that in the trailer.
Yeah. You can see there's been a massive attack there.
Tupac influence in there somewhere. Yeah.
And I find that that's just like a really, that really helps me quickly get to a look I want because I'm listening to something that's like quite relevant and it's making me feel the right way at the right time. So sometimes if I don't have a ton of time, I'll just, you know, crank some tunes that are really, really relevant to the picture. And then it kind of gets me in that mode and helps me sort of stick to it versus going down a tunnel into something and transforming into something that maybe it doesn't serve the theme or the genre or whatever of the film. So that's another kind of strategy I use. So I kind of write my gut reactions and I try to work with music to kind of keep me in the zone at all times, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, those are great tips. So on that note, I know you're busy.
Got to run, go do some more looking at things.
But I want to thank you very much for joining us. This is a real pleasure, and we hope Elysium does really, really well, and we look forward to seeing it. Thank you, Andrea Clayback.
Thank you, Juan.